You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 13th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy Hanukkah.
Oh, yay.
Hey.
Happy Hanukkah.
Yay.
So, guys, check this out. I had something pretty cool happen. So we didn't all buy Star Wars tickets together, and then we're trying to piece together, like, who's going to go when, and we all really wanted to go together. But the problem is, like, there were tickets that were, like, going to get us home at, like, 3 or 4 in the morning and that type of thing. I can't do that because I have kids. So I got tickets to go the day after Bob, Evan, and Steve are going. And then earlier today, my wife texts me and says, hey, our friend has an extra ticket and wants to bring Dylan with them. So this is our friend Celeste and her son. She has a 7-year-old son, Max, and they wanted to bring Dylan. So I wrote back and I'm like, no. And she's like, are you serious? And I said, Court, I've never been more serious than anything. Dylan's first Star Wars experience in a movie theater cannot be with just some friend of the family. Like, I have to be there. As a matter of fact, it should just be he and I alone. Like, seriously. And she still didn't think I was serious. Like, she just was like, oh, come on. You know, they're going to pick him up. I'm like, no, he's not going with them. You don't get it. Like, no, the answer is no.
Plus,
Jay, he's going to spoil it. That kid is not going to keep anything secret.
Forget him.
I know. So the
that's
next
Jay's
text,
real reasoning.
This is how awesome my wife is. The next text was, I somehow found the two of you tickets for tomorrow night at 7:30.
No, how?
Yes.
Thursday night.
Because there's, you know, a couple of seats, a straggler here and there, you know what I mean? But she found two seats together in a movie theater that has the great seats and, you know, it's like the assigned seats situation, which is, you know, profoundly better than just random seats. And that's it. I'm going to see it tomorrow at 7:30.
Well, don't you go spoiling it for us, then.
My God.
And it's, you know, it's me. So what ended up happening was I told her why it's so important to me. And this is what the call to action for her was. I said, the first time we saw Star Wars, the original movie in 1977, my dad took me and my brothers. And I'm like, Court, like, that is one of the best memories of my entire life, was experiencing that movie with my dad and my brothers. Like, and dad sat through two shows of it with it. We didn't leave our seats, remember?
Yeah.
We did not leave our seats. We refused to leave, and we stayed for the second showing. It was one of the best nights of my life. And I told her, I'm like, I can't let that memory, you know, not happen for me and Dylan, especially for Dylan. And then she got this, somehow pulled those seats out of her butt, and I'm going tomorrow night.
Yay.
Wow, that's awesome.
And
I'm psyched.
I'm not spoiling anything because I know nothing about it except that I read that it is the best of the modern Star Wars movies.
No
way. I heard there were some good reviews.
Yep.
Yeah, actually, I read
Kara, don't you get my hopes up.
Yeah, exactly.
No, guys, you got to say it.
That's the problem.
That seems to be the consensus.
They said that you could make an argument that it's better than Empire.
No,
I didn't say that. Hold on.
Stop the podcast. I pause.
I know. I need to see it. I gotta finish my schoolwork so I can go see it.
See, I told my daughter I'd wait for her. That's why I'm not seeing it until late Saturday night. She's getting off the train at like 8:30.
Oh, Julie will be there. Great.
Yeah, and then she'll come. We'll give her some rice lasagna, and then we're going to see Star Wars at 12:30 after midnight.
12:30 a.m. Hey,
Steve, so there's a bet behind your back, Steve, that you will not make it through the movie.
I'm going to nap in the afternoon.
Oh, that's smart.
Good idea.
I'm going to nap.
Good idea.
All right. Well, we'll try not to get too excited. That's good, Jay, because on Monday, December 18th, so right after the show comes out, we are going to review the new Star Wars movie on Alpha Quadrant 6. And Evan, you're going to join us. So we'll do the review. We'll stream it on the Alpha Quadrant 6 Facebook page at 7 p.m. Eastern time. And, of course, it'll be up there, and we'll put it up on YouTube afterwards. But that should be a lot of fun. Hopefully it'll be a positive review.
That's what we're hearing.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We shall see. All right, Bob, get us started with Forgotten Superhero of Science.
Yes, for this week's Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm covering Kathleen Mary Drew Baker, 1901 to 1957, UK phycologist. who single-handedly saved sushi as we know it today.
Save sushi?
Save sushi. This is a real fun story. Who's heard of nori?
Of course.
Of course. Nori is a long green seaweed used as that edible wrap around sushi and also a staple of Japanese cuisine. I didn't know much about that, but now I do. It's been ocean harvested on bamboo poles for centuries by Japanese, Chinese, and Korean farmers. But they called it lucky grass because no one ever saw seeds or seedlings or anything of how this thing actually grows, so they couldn't cultivate it. So they called it lucky grass because sometimes it was unpredictable. Sometimes they would grow, sometimes they wouldn't. So it was kind of annoying, but everybody loved it, so they would always try. I mean, at the best, they would see these long, thin filaments that would become the seaweed, but no one knew what that developed from. Then in the 1940s, with industrialization, pollution, and some nasty typhoons, they all combined to create, by 1951, all the nori was gone, almost all of it. There was no nori seaweed. It just totally tanked. And of course, everyone was pretty distraught. Then enter British phycologist Kathleen Drew Baker. Phycology is a study of algae, if you haven't figured that out. She was studying the life cycle of the red algae, Porphyra umbilicalis.
She wrote that paper that got turned into a Pixar movie called Finding Nori.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
That took a while, huh, Steve?
The buildup, I like it.
Good. She revealed in an academic paper that was published in Nature in 1949, that another green algae that she was studying, the microscopic Conchocellus, was not independent, as was previously believed, but it was just the precursor diploid stage to that macroscopic haploid red algae, the Porphyra umbilicalis. So they were connected. The key, though, is, as important as that was, the other critical insight that she made was that the tiny stage, that tiny microscopic stage, needed the shells, needed specific types of shells, like bivalve shells, as a nursery, essentially, to develop into the bigger algae. And that was critical. And soon after that, Japanese phycologist Sokichi Segawa read her work, and by 1953, Fuzao Ota and other marine biologists created these new artificial seeding techniques, and that led to ever increasing production, and eventually to what we have today, nori pretty much everywhere. So, of course, what she did was amazing, and everybody, especially in Japan, just fell in love with her. They named her Mother of the Sea in Japan. There's even a special Drew Festival in the city of Uto, Kumamoto in Japan. Festival. There's even a shrine for her there. I want a shrine. That would be cool. So, how awesome was that? So remember Kathleen Drew Baker, the Mother of the Sea. Mention her to your friends. Perhaps when discussing Zytosporangium or algology or even sexual conjugation.
Ooh.
Otherwise known as isogamy.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an interesting little story.
Yeah, but Bob, I don't like sushi.
I don't either.
I love it.
I don't either. So what? Who cares?
You don't eat sushi either, Bob? I don't eat seafood. That's why I don't eat sushi.
Yeah, I'm not big on seafood.
Raw seafood is nasty to me, but whatever.
I avoid the the shelly fishes.
I like it all. You guys are nuts.
And not just because I'm Jewish. It's not has nothing to do with
it. Wait. Evan, you're Jewish?
What? I am? Yes, I'm Roy Moore's lawyer. Yes. Oh, too soon?
Not soon enough.
Evan, screw you and the horse you rode in on.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, here we go. Okay.
Yes.
That's fun. Jay, tell us about Space Policy Directive 1.
Doesn't
that sound cool?
It sounds awesome.
It sounds like a new series coming out or something.
Or a new podcast review show.
So on December 11th of this year, 2017, President Trump signed his administration's first space policy directive, which I find to be interesting and scary until you find out about the details. So in short, because I know Bob is worried, the directive says that NASA should return to the moon first. The directive is named, as Steve said, Space Policy Directive 1.
It has that prime directive feel to it.
Absolutely. I love that. And it states that NASA's primary mission is for human space exploration with a goal of humans on the moon. So back in June of this year, Trump signed an executive order to reestablish the National Space Council, also known as the NSC. The NSC made recommendations to the executive branch of the U.S. government on anything to do with space, black holes, the Starship Enterprise, whatever. Everything that is basically out there, that's what they can talk about and advise on. And the last time a council like this existed was back in 1989. You know, it took 28 years for them to reinstate the council. I don't know why, but I'm really happy that they did. So interestingly, though, the NSC's recommendations were not to go straight to Mars after all. They said we should establish ourselves on the moon, and I happen to agree with this. I know that Steve agrees with this. I think the rest of you guys, when we talked about it, we were all...
I agree.
You know, I figured everyone agreed.
I have right? always said that for years.
Mm-hmm. Right. Bob, you were right. It was me and you in the beginning, remember?
Yep. And Steve kind of jumped on the bandwagon. Okay, go ahead.
That's not true. So, I actually came to that conclusion. I was persuaded by Isaac Asimov, who very persuasively made that opinion like 25, 30, 40 years ago. So I
awesome.
Probably have precedence on that. But go ahead.
You guys are such brothers.
So. Yeah, I know, right? We're kind of half-kiddingly seeing who's got the street cred. So
yeah, but did you meet Isaac Asimov or almost meet him like I did?
Yeah. I met someone who knew him.
Oh my god!
Recently,
well now I've met somebody who met somebody who knew him. You.
It's the new Kevin Bacon thing. 7 degrees of.
All right. So separation. Anyway, we're all correct because it does make a lot of sense to start with a solid presence on the moon. And here are some of the things that you can consider as we convince you, as Isaac Asimov convinced Steve 27.372 years ago. I think the most important fact here is that the moon base is so much easier to achieve. The moon is only 3 days away compared to 9 months, you know, give or take a little, with Mars. And the cost of survivability and the utility of a moon base, this is a no-brainer. Like, we can do this, and we can do it with the technology that we have today. And that's another very important fact.
Right. We can't go to Mars today with the present technology. Can't
yeah, we can't get people to Mars on today's technology.
Not alive.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a big part of it.
We to make a viable Mars base work would take, if you just look at it from a radiation perspective alone, we don't know how to solve that problem. There's millions of problems that need to be solved before we could do Mars. And space all by itself is just crazy dangerous as it is. So getting people there, everything about this is just way too much to bite off in the first lick here. So the Earth and the Moon are really close to each other. You know, and some might even say too close, right? But that's not the point. The point is that the moon could quickly be resupplied from the Earth. We could even help the moon base in an emergency. Like, yes. Think about, you know, because it's only a 3-day trip, we don't need this gigantic spaceship with everything. It could just be like something that's at the International Space Station that's ready to deploy to bring them emergency supplies, or, you know, a shuttle to get back in case something was going on. Now, Mars, on the other hand, would go down something like this. Hey, Earth, this is Mars. We're having a total emergency here. No, seriously, the shit has already hit the fan and we need help. Now, 13 minutes and 48 seconds later, the message would get to Earth. Then Earth would take about a year to get a rocket staged up to go help. 9 months of travel back to Mars, and the rocket would arrive and find that the astronauts went completely feral and now speak Navi, which is the language from the Avatar people.
Yeah. Is, oh, thank you.
That's
thank
my
you
way of saying they're dead. And they died a year and 8.5 months ago. There's no, you know, saving people that have problems on Mars. And, you know, and it really is the distance. The distance is what the killer is here. So everything we could learn about creating a base on another planet or a moon, we could do with our moon. We could do it with a moon base. And it would totally help
alpha.
With the technology
sure.
moving forward to get people mm-hmm. safely to
alpha,
Mars.
Yes.
Now, we talked about lava tubes a few weeks ago. This would be a great location to start a moon base. You know, the natural shielding from the radiation. We could even use like similar structures on Mars to do that in the future. Now, think about building the infrastructure on the moon and then launching moon missions or other deep space missions from the moon would be like, right? We could have the moon base build spaceships in orbit around the moon. The moon base could create fuel from the regolith on the moon, which NASA's already worked on. We would, of course, have to call the moon base Alpha. I'm sorry. You have to have a big sign on it that says moon base Alpha. That's just my stipulation here. And then, you know, you start talking about the fuel savings of not having to ship fuel from the surface of the Earth. That's another big thing here. Like, if we could create fuel on the moon, then we're not shipping it off the surface of the Earth, we're not putting it into orbit around Earth, and we're not taking that from Earth to Mars or from Earth to the Moon. It's all happening on the Moon. That could end up being tens of millions, you know, arguably even into the billions of dollars worth of cost to just not create the fuel here and move it all around. Then now the other thing that the SPD one said was this deep space gateway. The deep space gateway is this idea of a space station that's in orbit around the moon, and that space station would be the way or the entry point that all of explorers would go through to get to their next mission. So essentially we ship everyone to the deep space gateway, which is this awesome space station around the moon, like I said, and then they would pivot from there to their deep space mission. And the reason why that works is that that station would be serviceable from the moon. So people that are living on the moon would be able to take care of the station from there. It's local. It's already deployed. It's out of the gravity well of the Earth. Everything here just makes a lot of sense from an economic and safety perspective, and I can't make any rational reasoning to convince me that we need to go to Mars first.
Jay, yeah, I totally agree that everyone seems to be coming around to the fact that we got to go to the moon first. It makes perfect sense for so many reasons. Couple things, though. First off, what about robotic missions? I assume they're still going to do those. Or are they going to abandon them? Nothing would basically surprise
me. Didn't say anything about it.
Yeah. Secondly, this is all fine and good, but all I got to say is put your budget where your presidential memorandum is. That's it. Because other presidents have had these grand plans in the past. Obama, Bush, they've all had these great ideas. And without a budget, it just goes nowhere. And this isn't even an executive order. It's a presidential memorandum, which is kind of like general policy goals. So this is less meaningful than an executive order. So it's all wonderful, but what'd you say in your blog, Steve? Let me see the budget first before,
Don't tell me your priorities, show me your budget. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. That's it. So.
Right. It is a vague memorandum, but it basically is endorsing the report of the National Space Council. So if we assume Trump is just saying, yeah, whatever those guys said, that's what we're going to do. And so then you could look to the National Space Council recommendations for the details. And those details include, prioritizing going to the moon. It also includes abandoning the ARM, the asteroid redirect mission. So no asteroids, but we're going to go to the moon. Doesn't mention anything about robotic exploration. I'm assuming it doesn't touch that one way or the other. But and then, if you're being cynical, some people say this is also a way of saying that NASA is not going to be involved in climate research.
Yep.
Yeah.
Not surprised. Mm-hmm.
So, but again, that wasn't sort of specifically stated. The only thing that was specifically axed in the report. The only thing that was specifically axed was the asteroid mission.
Axed.
Yeah. Got cut.
Yeah. So anyway, and again, this doesn't. And unless he's willing to somehow get a budget for all of this, it doesn't really mean that much. But I do think as a general priority, I agree, go to the moon first and use that as a stepping stone to Mars.
Did you guys hear that Musk said, I think he tweeted the message, we should have a moon base by now and sent astronauts to Mars. The future needs to inspire. He's basically like, yeah, no shit. Of course, we need a moon base. We should have had one a decade ago.
Yeah.
I was talking to a friend of mine who were working on doing some development of some science communication training with one of the NASA brick and mortars. And he was saying that one thing he learned when he was having lunch with this representative from NASA is that the vast majority, I can't remember the number, but it was something obscene, 75%. Maybe it's not that high, but the vast majority of employees at NASA are over the age of 50.
Mm-hmm. That's a little scary.
Yeah, because there was after the Apollo stuff, we got this massive boom of people coming to work at NASA, and we haven't had something like that since then. And since they're all really good at their jobs, and these are career jobs, you take these jobs and then you work there until you retire, they haven't needed to replace most of them. And so we've got this big chunk of people who are going to be aging out at NASA soon, and I hope we have the talent to replace them.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Well, other countries have also increased their space capabilities and exploration over those decades as well. We could possibly tap into those resources as well, bring them into NASA and count on them to help us out.
Hopefully. Hopefully we can just round out the workforce as we need to.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Kara. It's funny how things work that way, right? We need something to inspire the next generation, and we need people to make education decisions based on cool stuff that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
To get semi-philosophical, humans, I think that we are a species of exploration. It's all throughout our history. And this really is
The final frontier.
It is. I you know, Bob, I paused in saying it because of how but it,
how about the next frontier?
It is the next frontier for us, and it's an important frontier. The fact that in the directive they said that they want to work with private companies, which is a huge step forward. You know, it's not just the government spending all the money on it. It's like we could privatize some of the operations here, make it turn a profit in one way or another, and then things are going to really explode from there, to use a bad word when you're talking about space travel.
Boom. All right. Well, we'll see if anything comes of this. All right, let's move on. This is an interesting little study I wanted to talk about very quickly. The researchers were looking at how well people were able to size up groups of people, right? So let's say you just get a flash image at a group of 20 or 30 people. What would you take away from that? And what they found is that in 500 milliseconds, right? 500 milliseconds, that's a half a second. People, subjects in the study, you know, they were basically shown a picture of a group of people for just 500 milliseconds. They were able to tell in that amount of time what the ratio of men to women were in the group with incredible accuracy.
Whoa, really?
And also would have a good idea of how many men total there were. So it's like, here's a group of people. What was the ratio? Men-women ratio, and how many men were there in the group. And they were extremely accurate at getting that, even in 500 milliseconds.
Hmm.
Yeah, which is really interesting. Other research also shows that we're very good at picking up, again, in just a blink of an eye, in just, you know, hundreds of milliseconds, we could discern someone's facial emotions, right? What someone's emotion based upon a quick, you know, glimpse of their face.
Well, gosh, I mean, people have been looking at the faces of people since, you know.
Yeah.
They could open their
1700s,
eyes.
1700s, so yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah, we have dedicated brain tissue for looking at faces, recognizing faces, interpreting facial expressions. So, yeah, that makes sense. But this is interesting. So this gets to the again, there's other research which really focused on individual people. And I know you guys have seen this. Remember, there's magic tricks, but really based upon social psychological studies where somebody – like you go up to a counter – to ask information of somebody, and then they say, okay, sure, let me get that for you. They lean down beneath the desk, and then somebody else stands up and gives it to you. And what percentage of people recognize that the person is a different person than the person you were looking at?
Oh, it's low, yeah. It's like
2 seconds ago. No, it's a little bit over 50%, like 55% will notice the change.
Which is low.
Which is low.
Yeah.
You think almost half the time you don't notice that the person you were just talking to has been replaced with a different person.
It's inattentional blindness.
They've done those studies where they replace it with a different gender and with a different ethnicity. And even still, like a certain percentage of people still don't notice.
What about alien?
Yes, but the percentage goes
changes.
Down.
Yeah, it goes down, of course. But there's still something like, I mean, whatever it is. There's some people out there where it'll be like, an Asian guy, and then it'll be like an African-American girl, and they won't even notice. Like, what?
Right, right. So
missing the details.
What the research suggests is that in a casual encounter like that, what we notice about people are their age category, their race, and their gender, right? So basically all that we notice is old white guy, you know, young Chinese woman, or whatever. That's it. That's it. And that's all we really perceive. And if you swap out one young white guy for another young white guy, we don't notice.
Yeah.
Because that's all that we, that's more detail than we processed.
Do people notice when their own ethnic grouping is swapped out more often than
a little bit more? Yeah, you're more attentive to your own group than not. So you also notice more my group or not my group, right? So this is a little, now we get to the sort of the hand waving social psychology stuff, but it all makes perfect sense when you think about it that way. From and again, for a little bit of further background, this gets to the system one, system two thinking. You know, the thinking fast and thinking slow, Daniel Kahneman stuff. So our brains are evolved to process certain bits of information very quickly, subconsciously, you know, the important stuff for survival. But it's not very detailed. It's not very accurate, but it's quick, dirty, and accurate enough. So it kind of is a window into what
evolution,
is evolutionarily really. Important, right? What bits of information provided a survival advantage? It's to the point that our brains were wired to quickly pick up on that information. So we definitely want to know if
that's cool.
When we encounter somebody, are they a man or a woman? Are they, you know, roughly what age category are they in? Are they, do they look like a member of my group or not my group?
Yeah, my tribalism.
And then also, how many men are there and what's the male to female ratio? So though,
in case that you get attacked.
Yeah, so which implies that that really directly relates to the threat that that potential individual or group poses. When I wrote about this, I pointed out that – have any of you guys watched the miniseries Godless?
No, heard about it, but haven't gotten to it yet.
Yeah, I watched a couple of episodes. I've never seen
it. So it's a Western. No. It's really good, by the way. I highly recommend it. But it's a straight-up Western. And you definitely – watching this show, because it's a very dangerous environment. You know, people are threatened all the time. And you know you're sort of looking out for the characters that you're following. And when, you know, you're, a character you're following comes up on a group, you, like them, sort of quickly size up the group to determine what kind of threat it is. And you definitely – are more threatened by a group of all men, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But if there are women in the group, it's like, okay, that's really reassuring because chances are it's like families, you know, or migrants or, you know, it's probably
and not an angry mob.
Not an angry mob of banditos or just
right. Or Bordello.
It was a funny experience watching that show. And, you know, that was my subjective experience. And then reading the study basically pointing out the same exact thing. And it's an interesting extension of the individual research. It's basically that the purpose of it was to extend it to groups. You know, what is the quick information that we will get even in 500 milliseconds? And that kind of implies what's important, what evolutionarily our brains think are important. And we are blind to everything beyond that, unless we specifically consciously pay attention, right? Then you have to invoke more of your conscious attention which takes more mental work rather than just your subconscious impression. Cool. And of course, you know, we talk about this all in the context of, as you say, inattentional blindness, change blindness, et cetera. Mm-hmm. We process a very tiny amount of the actual information that we're exposed to. And there are lots of rules about what information comes to our awareness, you know, and what gets filtered out. Interesting.
Man, I hope I would be one of those few people that would recognize the change.
I don't know. You can't know. It's like, you know, when you first do the gorilla and the basketball video, it's, you know.
Yeah, everybody.
I didn't see the gorilla. That's two. It's about half, you know, don't see it, you know, because it's just that's a different, I think, phenomenon, but it's very similar. And that's more of attention. That's pure inattentional blindness rather than just like what are the important, you know, subconscious versus conscious attention, you know?
Yeah, but that's because you're primed, right? And in life, we're primed too. So on the basketball thing, you're meant to follow the path of the basketball and count how many passes are made. So you're totally paying attention to that. But in life, let's say you're at the bank teller counter, you're like looking at your phone and you're paying attention to things, just not that person's face.
Yeah, I do. And I have, so I'm aware of this research. And then there are times where I catch myself. I'm like, all right, like I'm at a counter and paying for something. I probably could not pick this person in front of me out of a lineup right now, you know, and then I have to like look at them and I realize this is the first time I'm actually looking at this person. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Until I got triggered, you know, to think about it because I'm familiar with the research, I realized, wow, I really did not process what this person looks like. I could not – that person absolutely could have been swapped for somebody else and I would not notice.
Oh, that happens to me in life sometimes. Like people will come up.
I'm talking about in life.
Yeah, no, but I mean like where somebody will be like, hey, you know, we were at that dinner together and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I've literally never seen this person before.
Yeah.
Like not just like a bank test.
That's funny.
And I feel bad because I used to think maybe I have prosopagnosia, but then I realized I think I'm just a jerk. Like I really just don't pay enough attention to people's
faces.
You're
just human,
just the way the brain works, right?
Some people have better memories than other people.
Yeah, I went to Brugger's Bagels for lunch and I totally remember the person who cashed me out. Totally remember, but mainly because the damn tomato bisque soup wasn't hot enough.
Oh, well, see, they were triggered. Right. So.
But think about it next time you're casually interacting with a cashier or something and you know, I definitely realized I would not recognize that person.
Yeah.
You know, if I didn't then consciously look at them and look at the details, which is why, by the way, eyewitness testimony is shit.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You know? Absolutely.
But don't let it get to you. Big deal. We're human. I mean, that's the way it is.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
no judgment. Right? No judgment. It's just interesting. It's an interesting phenomenon.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
And
I'm
much more aware of how unaware I am, you know, because.
Right. And the tie-in to eyewitness testimony is even more interesting.
I wonder if you could train yourself to become more aware.
Sure, like spies.
Oh, I maybe. Think so. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Like oh my spies? God, yeah.
mentalist.
Yeah. Well, that's like a cliche of spy movies where like that part of the training is like I can't remember the movie, but like somebody walking
Bourne,
through the room.
Bourne.
Yeah,
well, it's like, it was the first Bourne movie. That was
but
awesome.
But
this
was even
so cool.
Before that. I think it was a trope
yeah,
for a long time.
Even oh, older sure, sure. movies. Yeah. Older movies. Yeah, like being able to like count every item that was in the room you just strolled through and things like that, you know.
Yeah, like Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, like Holmes, exactly. Powers of observation. All right, Kara, tell us about ticks, dinosaurs, and amber.
This is cool, but don't get your hopes up if you're a big fan of Jurassic Park.
No.
I know. There was a study that was published just yesterday, as of this recording, in Nature Communications called Parasitized Feathered Dinosaurs as Revealed by Cretaceous Amber Assemblages. So, of course, as that name implies, it has a lot of really pretty pictures of some ticks in amber, and they came out of Myanmar. So, of course, these are Burmese amber, which I guess, reading a lot about this, is where some of the just best amber specimens seem to come from. And there's all these cool pictures in the study. I highly recommend that you actually go to the study. You can get the full text online, and you can see all the really neat pictures of like confocal microscopy and just like different ways that they're imaging these things. Now, one of the ticks has its leg tangled up in a dinosaur feather, which is freaking awesome. And another one is full of blood. They say it looks like it's engorged 8 times its original size. So yes, they think there is a tick full of blood in that amber, but no, like I said, don't get your hopes up. There's likely no DNA. It's probably really, really, really degraded. That one is also quite towards the surface of the amber. So they think there's a lot of effects on that tick that probably, it's probably a bit desiccated and just not, doesn't have any like, even probably full proteins.
Yeah, and Kara, the report said specifically there is no DNA in that blood.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like not only
probably there's no DNA.
Yeah, not only is there no DNA, there's no chance probably of there ever being DNA when something is that old. Right. And we've talked about that a lot on the show. So let's talk about how old it is. This was about 99 million years old. They think that the type of dinosaur or bird, actually, this is more like a primitive bird, and I'm going to try and pronounce this. I studied it. It's Enantiornithine. This is the group of these really
like
primitive
that.
Birds. Yeah, it's a very hard word to say, Enantiornithines. There were a lot of them. They had little teeth in their beaks, so they still had some dinosaurian features to them. But they went extinct about 99 million years ago, and they think it was likely an Enantiornithine and not a modern bird, because those modern birds didn't show up until 25 million years later than how old this amber is. So they think it has to be one of these, I almost just said vintage birds. Wow. One of these extinct proto birds because of how old it is. But it is impossible to know exactly what these ticks were feeding on. The really significant finding in this paper is that it's the first sort of in situ evidence of the fact that parasites and blood-sucking parasites actually fed on these organisms because it's entangled in this dinosaur feather. And almost every researcher who's looked at this has said this is, you know, almost irrefutable evidence that these suckers were around for this long and that, and that they literally sucked the blood of these, you know, organisms 100 million years ago.
Why would there have been reason to think?
Well,
otherwise?
Because I don't think that
evidence.
They ever had seen it. Yeah. And so it was all speculative.
Well, sure,
and nobody
okay.
thought otherwise, but it was all speculation until now. And they don't have ticks that are much older than that, but they've looked at modern tick DNA, and using molecular clock dating, they think that ticks are 200 to 300 million years old. So there could even be more evidence out there. There are like 230 million year old mites that have been found trapped in amber. And, you know, older buggers like that, but none in situ with actual matter from a larger organism that they likely parasitize. So that's really the super cool finding
that's
here.
That's very cool.
It's very cool.
Yes.
They also did name a new tick species out of this study. Yeah. How to say it? I know it's Draculi is the species name, but what was the...
Like
Dinocroton. So Dinocroton Draculi.
Yeah, which is pretty freaking cool. That's pretty
awesome
cool.
Name.
Yeah, isn't that cool? I love that name. So
when you look at this picture of the tick, mm-hmm. you're thinking, okay, maybe however old, tens of millions of years this tick is.
100 million.
Looks like a modern
tick. Yeah, looks like a modern tick, and it's 100 million
looks
years
like
old.
A modern tick.
Yeah.
So not much has changed in the world of ticks, apparently, at least from this.
Yeah, at least morphologically, they don't seem that different to us. And
no saber-toothed
ticks
or anything.
That's often a sign of an organism really locking down its evolutionary niche. I'm saying that to our British listeners.
Right, it got there.
I say niche, too. I don't say niche, but that's a very American thing. Some Americans say niche, but I think they sound pedantic.
Niche is American, niche is British.
That's, exactly. So you sometimes will hear Americans saying niche, but they're probably the same people that say vase and foyer, which we do not say. That said, it's a good sign. You see this a lot with organisms, you know, like the coelacanth, who just haven't changed that much since their older ancestors because they've, you know, they really own that niche and they haven't needed to change. That's really how evolution works, right? They haven't really felt the pressures to have to keep up. So,
But the other thing
cool
is, Kara, this amber was purchased at a mart.
Mm-hmm.
And they really do need to get some scientists in there and own that amber because they're basically a lot of times it's sold to private collectors who then donate it to a museum. That's like we're dependent on charity.
Well, and that's what this was too.
That's what I'm saying.
It ended up at the Natural History Museum or the American Museum of Natural History where people could study it. And some private collector, I'm learning a lot about this kind of world of private dinosaur or private fossil collectors and also private meteorite collectors because I've been doing stories about this for television lately. And there's a big push-pull between the scientific or academic community and the private collection community. And I think sometimes it's a boon when they can work together because private collectors often have more money, which is hard because it does raise the market price. But then again, the market price might be raised anyway. So I think the private collectors that I respect most are the ones who collect for the intent of having collections that they can loan then to museums and academic institutions. And there are some really well-known people who have these collections that are constantly on loan or that have their own labs actually and offer a great place for people to come and study. I think that's really the only way to do it. The idea that people can buy these things in markets and then put them in their, you know, medicine cabinets and they never see science seems to me it is problematic. And different countries have different laws around that. We do too. You know, we have land right laws here in the United States. If you found it, you get to own it. But then again, even on these digs, I don't know if you've seen these kind of commercial digs where you can pay to go out with some paleontologists and help them with their field work. And whatever you find, you keep with all these restrictions. It's like whatever you find, you can keep if it's a tooth and it's not scientifically significant and it's and of course
can't be any larger than
if it's a femur, no freaking way are you keeping it. If it's a skull, no way. But that said, everything is scientifically significant, and I think it's just, you know, when you ask different experts about this, especially people who work in museums, curators and things, they'll say everything scientifically significant, even trilobites, there are tons of them, but a good well-rounded museum collection has a lot of different organisms. At a certain point, though, there are so many that it's probably not that big a deal for private collectors to have them. I myself have some trilobites. I myself have some meteorites that are named meteorites, but I don't have type specimens of anything, obviously, and I don't have anything that would be better off in a museum. And I think that's the best way to think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Evan, tell us about extremophiles in Antarctica.
Oh, I will do that, because new research has been reported in the journal Nature, and it's shown that the desert soils of Antarctica harbor surprisingly rich microbial communities. Very cool. So researchers were asking the question, what supports life in those communities with low photosynthetic capabilities or capacity? And the researchers were able to find evidence that trace gases in the atmosphere turn out to be the primary energy sources for at least two of Antarctica's surface soil communities. They discovered bacterium in Antarctica that can survive solely off chemicals in the air. The microscopic organisms can survive on just hydrogen, carbon monoxide, and carbon dioxide. They're suggesting that this discovery opens up new possibilities about the existence of extraterrestrial life forms living in the most harsh conditions that we can imagine in the universe. Okay. So essentially, these bacteria can survive with basically no sunlight, no geothermal energy, and extremely limited nutrients.
So what is their source of energy?
The hydrogen and the carbon monoxide.
Just that. That's just
those,
enough.
Those molecules have energy. You know, they can drive chemical reactions.
So chemosynthesis.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So light, you know, is not necessarily a component to that. But what they're suggesting is that to date, researchers have maybe been bypassing this set of criteria for those who are looking for life forms on exoplanets, say, or other places in space. And they think we maybe need to go back and start looking for some of these other signatures because it could indicate that some form of life can survive on, you know, just these very, very rare forms of energy.
But, like, I don't understand that argument. To what end? It's not like we have any way. All we can do is look at the spec to determine whether or not something is in a Goldilocks zone. We can't actually go there and sample it. So whether or not we classify it one way or the other, there's no action that we can take afterwards.
I think that the alien angle was totally gratuitous for headlines, you know. You know, this prompts rethink of humanity's search for alien life. That's the bullshit, you know, marketing of.
Yeah, because it's like we already know that things can happen in like extreme locations. We think about that in astrobiology. The truth is we only have the means to like go to places in our own solar system as it is right now. And yes, it's important to classify exoplanets like we've been doing. And no, we don't just classify exoplanets within the traditional Goldilocks zone because we've known for years that it doesn't have to fall in a certain amount of sunlight because it can have tidal energy. It can, you know, there's all these other ways to find energy. So I don't know. Right. I don't understand the practical implications of this.
There isn't one. I agree. Because, what we can do is we could look at the light passing through an exoplanet's atmosphere and then use spectroscopy to see what's in the atmosphere.
Yeah, and so we do that already.
All you could do is say this planet, even though there's no oxygen there, it still may be a planet with life if it has these other things in it, you know.
Yeah,
like if it had methane, that's another good pointer.
Sure.
But the thing is, couldn't you also look, instead of looking for perhaps byproducts of photosynthesis, perhaps you could look for byproducts of chemosynthesis and possibly identify planets that otherwise would not have been identified?
But I don't think what we do is we only look for Goldilocks or life-supportive exoplanets. We look for all exoplanets. They're all cataloged. Anything that looks could be a planet around a star.
We look where the light is good. We look for the planets that we have the technology to detect.
Exactly. That doesn't seem to have the right chemical signal. Let's not classify it.
I mean, at most, they're making sort of a general point that life may be – there may be more possible locations for life in the universe than just ones that mimic the Earth.
Oh, yeah.
And that's nothing new. Yeah. That's nothing new.
That's not.
This just adds that. There's bacteria that are purely chemosynthetic that don't need light. Okay, yeah, we kind of already knew that, but
It's fascinating. We have communities at the bottom. We have chemosynthetic communities at the bottom of the ocean. I mean, we've known this for decades.
It's interesting, right? But applying it to the search for extraterrestrial life, it's not like this is some breakthrough that's all
gratuitous.
Of a sudden is going to reveal life on
All right, Bob, what's this water cloak thing you're supposed to talk about?
scientists recently had a mini conceptual breakthrough envisioning a cloak around a submersible that not only prevents detection, but much more interesting, it virtually removes its drag and wake, potentially allowing amazingly efficient underwater travel. So this one, it was exciting, mainly because it reminded me of one of my favorite sci-fi series, Neil Asher's Polity Universe. In one of his novels, he had an awesome AI war drone whose name was Sniper. It had a fusion engine that could travel at Mach speeds underwater.
That's
and I was
crazy.
Just fascinated by all those scenes. And it's kind of related to what we're seeing here. So the original non-science fiction idea for this came at Duke University in
in 2011. The general idea was the conclusion was at that time that if you could move water around an object to match the movement of the object itself, then the propulsion efficiency underwater would be improved by orders of magnitude potentially. So, and of course, moving through water, as we all know, is obviously – it's not easy. Water is viscous. Moving water tends to pull nearby water along with it because of the shear forces. And I'm reminded of pushing my little adorable niece, Olivia, through the water this past summer in our pool. And it's not – not nearly as easy as moving her through the open air when she's going in a direction you want her to go into, at least. So drag is another potential problem as well. It's for non-hydrodynamic shapes. It creates terrible turbulence that can slow you down even more. For example, the Enterprise would move much more smoothly through the water than a Borg cube, for example. Kind of obvious, but that's mostly drag. Yeah, that's drag. This recently updated theory came from Yaroslav Erzumov, who is an adjunct assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at Duke. Now, his new approach moves away from the original idea that he and the group had in 2011 with these tiny complex pumps to in a direction involving electromagnetic fields that can move saltwater charged particles. And that's really the crux of it. So using wires and coils, he figures he can create an electromagnetic field around a vehicle that can move dissolved ions like potassium, magnesium, and sodium. So now there's so many of them in salt water that he thinks he can move the water immediately around a submersible, say, precisely enough to pull this off. And I mean, that sounds fantastic, but there was actually a kind of a prototype ship built by Japan in 1991 called the Yamato 1, which is based on a very similar idea of using these forces as a means of propulsion. I think ultimately they found that it wasn't any more efficient than conventional propellers. But that was then, and this is now. So modern fluid dynamic simulations show that this field should be able to control the speed and direction of the water in such a way. So try to imagine this. The water that's within the cloak or right around the submersible would be unmoving compared to the water outside it. So it would be kind of like stagnant, right, compared to the water that's outside of the cloak. This would remove not all, but a significant fraction of the drag and wake generated by a moving submersible. And that's pretty much the crux of it right there. But there's another piece here that was very important, perhaps even the most important realization that Erzumov had that he makes in his paper, was that the greater speeds would not require complicated controls. So basically, to go faster and faster and faster, all you really need to do was hit the accelerator, and that was it. He says here that if you don't have to adjust the distribution of forces, you don't need any electronic switches or any other means of dynamic control. You can set the structure with a specific configuration and simply crank up the current as the object speeds up. So it's not complicated to go faster and faster. So of course this would require a lot of power to implement, especially in something like a modern day submarine. In fact, it probably would need something on the scale of a nuclear reactor. But hey, nuclear reactors and submarines, been there, done that. That shouldn't be a problem. So there's other potential applications as well for this that are outside the ocean, he claims. He says that distributed ion propulsion system for spacecraft could find this useful. And also it could be used to suppress plasma instabilities for thermonuclear fusion reactors. So perhaps we may yet see an AI drone traveling at Mach 1 or more underwater in the future. So that would be awesome. Oh, you imagine?
Wow. Yeah, neat.
Don't hit a whale.
Yeah.
Well, that's the there's a lot of stuff to try here. Yeah. Gee.
That reminds me of flying through space at very high impulse power near the speed of light. You know, you hit like a dust mote and it blows through your ship because of the kinetic energy, even for something really tiny, if it's moving close to the speed of light, you will be
like dusting craps, boy. Star Wars.
Ev, really?
Oh, is that where that's from? Thanks, Evan.
It was for Kara's sake.
All right. Thank you, Evan.
You're welcome.
All right, Jay, who's that noisy?
All right, last week I played this noisy. So what is it?
Someone
I don't know, but I love it.
Pants clinking in the background.
It's a beautiful world, like world music. It's like an ethnic song from somewhere, but I don't know where. But obviously, it's also been processed by, I don't know, a kitchen utensil or something crazy.
So I will say that this may very well be the most responded to "Who's That Noisy" I ever played.
No way, really?
Okay. Yeah, apparently a lot of people know exactly what this is, and
that's awesome.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. I did take a closer look at the emails I received, and a lot of the people that wrote me are Nordic.
Huh, interesting.
So that's a hint. That's a hint, because I can recognize Nordic names by their name and by the country that they're in. Mm-hmm.
So you claim. Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
And the songs they sing.
I really like this noisy just because there's nothing, how do I put this? It's pretty straightforward, right?
Oh, so it wasn't processed by a kitchen utensil.
No. And there was a clue in there. I mean, for the people that actually had to do research, because a lot of people knew the answer. One person actually even said, oh my God, all those crazy nights of just looking at random crap on the internet finally paid off. That was the response. Like, I saw that video. I can't believe I know the noisy. The clue was the cowbell.
Okay.
Right? That was the clue. And I think I pointed that out last week. Someone actually wrote in and said, needs more cowbell, which I loved. This is actually, and we did have a winner from last week. This is actually, Hakon Lund said, hi. What we heard on this week's noisy was the sound of a budi, Norwegian for dairymaid, doing a lock, Norwegian for cattle call, which is basically singing the cattle back to the barn for the night.
Oh,
during summertime.
So
I know, isn't it beautiful?
Yeah.
The farm animals would roam freely, so when nighttime came, they had to be called back to the farm. And that's how they did it here in Norway and many other European countries, for that matter, back in the day. Yeah, you just train the cows to come back to that noise, and then the next generation of cows will learn from the previous generation, and it just kind of goes with them.
I love it.
Okay, wow.
Very cool, right?
Yes. What's the twist? There's no twist?
There's no twist. The trick was that there was the cowbell in the background, and I thought that people that wouldn't recognize it would be able to at least have something to search on, because that is clearly a cowbell.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was absolutely beautiful. I loved it.
Neat. Good one, man.
Yeah, I like that.
What do you got for this week?
Steve, you know who Steve Harris is, right?
Yep.
We've mentioned him before. He's a friend of the show. He sent in a noisy for us this week, and I really like it, and I want to play it for you.
Sure.
Like to hear it?
If you insist. Yes.
And here they go.
Oh, man, that sounds familiar.
Yes. I thought so too, Bob. But I knew what it was when I was listening to it. But I did get a similar sensation that you. Like, I've heard that before. If you think you know what that is, or if you have a really good noisy that you heard this week, do not hesitate. Just email it to me. Just email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Help a brother out.
All right. Thanks, Jay. One email this week. This one comes from Evelyn McLean from Los Angeles, California. And Evelyn writes, I recently watched this short film on grounding, or earthing, a seemingly miraculous technique for dealing with chronic pain caused by inflammation. Part of my skepticism about this field stems from the simple fact that if this information was as important as is claimed in the movie, it would probably be more widely known. That's very insightful, Evelyn. The other part of my skepticism is about the way I came to see the movie, a post on Facebook. But the film produces some pretty convincing evidence, testimonials from medical doctors and physicists, and 20 scientific studies which have been published in peer-reviewed medical journals. I'll be looking into this further on my own, but I'm curious, could there be something to this, or is it another convenient solution that tries to explain away too many unrelated problems? Well, Evelyn, I'm afraid this is all bullshit and nonsense. This is earthing. I wrote about this many years ago, actually, and I was intrigued by this notion that there are 20 scientific studies. First of all, don't be impressed by that. Also, don't be impressed by testimonials. Testimonials are crap. I don't care who they come from. They're just not reliable, especially if you have a film with an editorial point to it. You know, they're trying to promote a specific narrative. And then they're going to, you could find testimonials to support any narrative you want. So let's take a look at the studies they're talking about. So first of all, a little bit of background. What is earthing? And you guys ever hear about this?
Oh, yes.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just a few minutes ago.
Yeah, it's the idea that if you walk on the earth when you're bare feet, the electrons from the earth will go into your body and will have an anti-inflammatory and antioxidant, of course, effect and cure whatever ails you. So just right there, that's just nonsense. It's not so the idea is that because you walk on insulated shoes that you're not able to enter your natural electrical homeostasis, right?
Oh, God.
You guys have walked across the room and gotten shocked off on a doorknob, right?
Yeah. I enjoy it.
Yeah. In winter, it happens all the time, yeah.
That's what happens when you're not in your electrical homeostasis, right? You have static electricity. The bigger point is that, you know, if you did have too much or too few or whatever electrons, you would be discharged every time you touch something. You know what I mean? It's not like you need to be communicating electrically with the earth through your bare feet in order for that to happen. That's just nonsense. So the basic premise is flawed. And of course, you know, I've spoken many times about why, you know, saying that something is an antioxidant. Antioxidants are not good for you. There's no evidence, and there isn't really even a good scientific rationale for why increasing your antioxidants is healthy. Our bodies have evolved a natural homeostasis between antioxidants and oxidative stress. Your body makes antioxidants naturally that are thousands of times more potent than anything that you could eat or consume. And if it was, you know, more healthy to have more antioxidants, your body would just make a little bit more of what it already makes, right? So evolution has already sort of reached some sort of optimal balance point. Oxygen-free radicals actually serve a purpose. I mean, you know, they are used for purposes in the body. And so if you either anything you eat or do like this, it will have no effect or an insignificant effect. Or if it actually did have an effect, it would probably be bad because you would be moving the system away from optimality, from its natural homeostasis. Yeah, it's natural homeostasis. You know, conceptually, the whole idea is flawed at multiple levels. But of course, I always get intrigued when people claim that there are scientific studies supporting their position. So I searched the internets. I did a PubMed search. All right, what's published here on earthing? And there are some studies that are published. They are almost entirely in utterly crap journals, not prestigious peer-reviewed journals. So Medical Hypotheses, you guys remember that one? Medical Hypotheses is a completely worthless journal, which will, in my opinion, which will publish any speculative nonsense, just made-up nonsense. They will publish it. And then the other ones are all the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine or something that.
Yeah.
There's a couple that snuck their way into like throwaway the Journal of Inflammation or whatever. Inflammatory research. You know, these are not prestigious journals. That's one red flag right there. Then you look at the studies. Another red flag, I always look for this. Another red flag is that the same few authors are appearing on all these studies.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's like, okay, it's basically one group of researchers that are pursuing this notion. It's not like it's getting independently replicated by prestigious researchers at academic institutions or whatever. It's just a few guys with an axe to grind. And then you look at the individual studies and they're all crap, right? They're preliminary. They're not blinded. They're very small numbers, They reek of p-hacking. Remember, p-hacking is when you manipulate the way in which you do a study in order to achieve statistical significance.
Right. Stop measuring once you've reached your goal. Oh, that's it. Yeah. We read it.
So here was one study comparing 32 people, so 16 in each group, again, tiny, looking at various effects, one with grounding, one with sham grounding. Doesn't say if they're blinded, so I always assume they're not if it doesn't say that they were. And then they're measured. This is like after a moderate eccentric contractions of the muscle. So this is like a mild muscle, you know, trauma. And then they looked at CPKs, which is a muscle enzyme that gets released after muscle trauma, and just subjective analog pain scales. And they say on day one, the participants performed eccentric contractions of 200 half knee bends. They were then grounded or sham grounded. Both groups experienced pain on all post-test days. Okay, no change in pain. On day two, the sham grounded group experienced significant CK increase, P equals less than 0.01, whilst the CK of the grounded group did not increase significantly that's a deception. You think, oh, P less than 0.01. That sounds pretty good. But that was just baseline to after effect. The only thing that really matters is comparing the two groups. The between group difference was 0.04, which is barely significant. And this is just only on day two. Why only on day two? And then there was an increase in the neutrophils of the grounded group on day three of 0.05. So again, just right barely significant only on day three of the neutrophils. Why the neutrophils? How many different things did they measure? How many, you know, they, so that is P hacking, right? You're just pulling out random days of some, how many different comparisons did they make? You know,
yeah,
a couple of them eke over this tiny group. So a couple of them eke over the statistical significance, and they probably wouldn't if they actually controlled for multiple comparisons.
Right.
So that's P hacking. That's crap. It's a crap study. It, you know, published in a crap journal, you know, and so that's basically what we have. But it's very easy to make it seem superficially impressive to people who don't know, you know, who aren't experts in interpreting scientific studies.
Mm.
Right. And so you get this movie, which is promoting this idea. And the red flags that Evelyn did pick out are legit. Yeah. If this is as impressive, this is, I always say, if this is half as impressive as they're claiming, why isn't there a tremendous amount of scientific and academic interest in this? And then you go to the conspiracy theory, right? Which is always the last refuge of the scoundrel, right? If you
special
have to
pleading.
Appeal, yeah, to a conspiracy theory, that just means you don't have a good answer for that. The real answer is because it's crap. Because it's not genuinely interesting, because it's not plausible, the evidence is not convincing, it's not getting published in prestigious journals. You know, this is throwaway p-hacking nonsense, just the background noise that just exists and that doesn't garner any interest because it shouldn't garner any interest.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But it is superficially sound, sciencey enough. Oh, we're getting insulated. And if you connect with the earth, you'll get the flow of electrons, which will have an antioxidant effect, whatever. It's easy to make it seem sciencey. It's the very definition of pseudoscience. It's pretending to be science, but it's not doing the real work of science. It's just, you know, doing studies which are basically designed to show that stuff happens, right? That's kind of how I look at a lot of these studies. These are the stuff happens studies where you're just showing, right? They're just showing that there is some marker somewhere is changing somehow and can't really confidently extrapolate from whatever it is you're seeing to there's something meaningful and beneficial clinically happening. And then there isn't ever any good study with rigorous protocol looking at a objective clinical outcome and showing a clear statistically and clinically significant difference in a double-blinded, you know, rigorous format. You never get that, right? You never get that in a replicable way. You always get just these nibbling around the edges, p-hacking kind of random markers, and then they weave that into their narrative, you know, completely unconvincing.
Cool.
But thanks for sending that in, Evelyn. It's, Earthing is a fun pseudoscience to talk about and not one that gets a lot of play. Yep. All right, let's move on with science or fiction.
Oh, boy.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready? Some interesting ones this week.
We're always ready.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. I know, it's a rhetorical question. Here we go. Item number one, scientists report a breakthrough with hydrogen-boron fusion using lasers and predict a working prototype within 10 years. Item number two, engineers at Wageningen University have developed a system by which they can harvest electricity directly from plants and bioengineered a tree that, when mature, several together can produce enough electricity to power a small home. And item number three, researchers demonstrate a method they claim can be used to convert 850 million tons of atmospheric CO2 into a mineral each year using seawater and scrap metal and producing hydrogen as a side product. Bob, why don't you go first?
We got hydrogen boron fusion using lasers. Yeah, that's awesome. This doesn't surprise me. We need a fusion breakthrough, and I just want that to be real too much. So that's science. All right, so engineers have developed a system harvesting electricity from plants. We got a tree
several trees to power a small home. Ah, what? That's just too awesome. That's too awesome to be real. So let's go to the third one. Let's see, convert the whole bunch of atmospheric CO2 into a mineral. Into a mineral. Yeah, whatever. That seems plausible, I think. But the tree one, no, come on. Three trees are going to power your home? Imagine hooking up to a forest. What you could do. I'm going to say that's fiction anyway.
All right, Jay.
This one about the hydrogen-boron fusion using lasers. Hydrogen. So Bob said that this, he hopes that this one is real, which is a data point for me. And in a recent analysis of Who's That Noisy, when Bob and I agree on which one is the science, we are 72% likely of being correct.
Nice.
Oh, right, Bob?
Okay. That sounds plausible.
That's a little bit of a sneak peek on some of the statistics we have coming at you at the year-end show.
Yeah, but that's only if you agree organically. If you agree with him, just to capitalize on that, it doesn't work.
You can't prove that, so I will do what I want.
That's like an anecdote to me. Yeah.
How dare you go against science, Steve? My God, 13 years of podcasting and now this. Okay. But I tend to think that Bob is correct. I want this to be true, too, and I think it's science. But the second one here at Wageningening University, Steve claims they developed this system by which they can harvest electricity from plants. I'm agreeing with Bob, Steve. I think I'm agreeing with him that this is ridiculous. See, 72% of the time, Bob. I mean, it just seems like, what do you mean? Like the plants are actually generating electricity, not enough to power a small home. I highly doubt it's making a thousandth of the power for that. So I am kind of agreeing with Bob. And then this last one, this one about the seawater and the 850 million tons of atmospheric CO2. Yeah, I mean, that's more believable to me than the electricity one. So I agree with Bob.
Okay, Evan.
GWB.
Yeah, I'm leaning that direction as well. It's a matter of scale. They probably bioengineered a tree. It probably does produce electricity. But the problem here, I think, is powering a small home. Nah. I mean, it'll probably be like 1/100th or 1/1000th of the power to generate electricity for a small home. So I will say it's a matter of scale, and therefore that one is going to be the fiction.
And Kara.
Oof. I guess I got a GWBJE.
Yeah, all right.
You're just lemming right over the cliff with the guys?
I got to. I'm just going to lemming on over.
All right.
Welcome.
All right. So let's just take these in order then, I guess. We'll start with number one. Scientists report a breakthrough with hydrogen-boron fusion using lasers and predict a working prototype within 10 years. You all think this one is science. And this one is science.
All right.
Yay, fusion. Yeah.
Whoa.
So, you know, obviously you take that with a grain of salt, the whole working prototype within 10 years. They did throw in a couple of caveats there. If we run into no unanticipated major hurdles.
Right, like the thing blowing up.
Yeah. How often does that happen? Have you read this, Bob?
Yeah, I did read this one, and this one got me very excited. This one, it looks like a really viable alternative to the torus, you know, using a magnetic field to contain the plasma, that and only using two lasers. I guess they shoot them off alternatively. They have some nonlinear interaction and collapse to create the high temperatures. I mean, that's, you know, this sounded, I mean, they were encouraging. They were very encouraging. Yeah. Man, we just, please.
So essentially, this is different than the hydrogen deuterium kind of fusion that the other, you know, facilities are working on, like the ITER, the National Ignition Facility in the U.S. So those use strong magnetic fields, you know, to get the hydrogen together. This is using lasers, and it's using hydrogen and boron. Now, previous models indicate that in order to get hydrogen and boron to fuse, you need temperatures of 300 billion degrees Celsius, which is 200 times hotter than the core of the sun.
The core. Hello, core.
What is that
about?
Wow. Yeah. That's hot. 3 billion degrees. So, but they think they can get there. So they think it's all about the laser technology. They're saying what the advance is that the lasers are getting more powerful, you know, bigger, better, cheaper. And we're just getting to the point where they're going to be powerful enough to pull this off. And there's a number of advantages to hydrogen boron fusion. One is, this is interesting, Bob, it doesn't just generate heat that you would then use to turn a turbine. It directly, right, directly produces electricity.
Directly, man. How awesome is that? Jeez.
Yeah. Right? Think about that. So it's not, you can bypass the whole turbine thing. It's just cranks out electricity. Imagine if you could miniaturize this and you just have a thing just generating electricity. Anyway.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yes. I want a buried fusion reactor that will power my neighborhood for decades.
Yeah.
That's a holy grail.
Or centuries.
Yeah, why you sell
millennia.
Yourself
short?
Power a city for thousands of years. Okay, not only that, there's no radioactivity, which is also
that's
a
helpful.
Pulse.
Yeah,
no radioactive waste.
No neutrons.
Yeah, so it you know, there's a lot of potential advantages. So yeah, and they're very excited about this. But again, it's always that grain of salt. So yeah, if everything now goes perfectly well and we run into no other speed bumps, theoretically we could have a prototype within 10 years. Which means that who knows, right? You know.
Yeah. Okay. But.
Yeah, but still, it's another feasible pathway. Yeah, another feasible pathway. And of course, if we can, you know, make a fusion reactor. We're not talking about cold fusion here, right? We're talking about hot fusion. If we can produce a stable fusion reaction that generates more energy than it consumes, because obviously these lasers consume a lot of energy, then we're off to the races, right? Then we can power the world.
Changing. Yeah. World changing.
This is a transformative technology. Good. Okay.
I have predicted that the country or countries or consortium or whatever that first produces this and can basically franchise it, I assume, you know, they would be like, okay, you know, we have this, you know, we will build this in your country for, you know, just give us, you know, $10 billion. That whoever does that, whatever does that, they're going to set the stage for the next generation or two or three of just they're going to be it. They're going to be the Google, Facebook, you know, all wrapped
of
into
countries.
One. Yeah, right. Amazon.
You were kidding when you said you were excited about this.
Oh, come on. Fusion,
he's been thinking about it a lot, Ev.
I want that AI war drone that could go at Mach 3 under the water. Yes, with a fusion engine in its butt.
They will be the richest company in the world, right next to the company that first finds a platinum asteroid and brings it back.
That's right.
Which is why I'm bummed that they're gonna. They might bail on that because that's. Why can't we do both?
The private industry
will be private.
Yeah. That will.
All right. Let's go on to number two. Engineers at Wageningen University have developed a system by which they can harvest electricity directly from plants and bioengineered a tree that, when mature, several together can produce enough electricity to power a small home. Let me just read you from the PlantE.com website. That's the name of the company, PlantE. PlantE develops products in which electricity is generated with living plants. The products are based on a technology that was developed at Wageningen University. In 2007, the technology was patented, and PlantE was able to get the patents from the university in 2009. The technology enables us to generate electricity with living plants at practically every location where plants can grow and water is abundantly available. So, what do you guys think about that?
I'm not convinced.
It's pretty impressive, huh?
It's impressive,
but and what are they? They're powering like a path light.
It powers a tiny LED bulb.
Yes!
Well, I was right!
I knew it!
I said it was 1,000th. I was right.
Yeah, just it produces a teeny amount of energy. It's for novelty. But yeah, not powering your home. That was way, way too much.
Still pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And there was another item which I didn't cover, but where it's another one where they engineer plants that glow in the dark, and they're trying to get them bright enough that they could actually be used as like street lamps, you know, just like a tree that glows.
Yeah,
that
would be cool
we covered too. That like 3 years ago. I distinctly remember
I know
that.
It's not that whole thing is not new, but this is like a new breakthrough.
Okay, new twist.
Not that cat or dog that glows. They did that 2 years ago.
Yeah. All right, let's go on. Number three, researchers demonstrate a method they claim can be used to convert 850 million tons of atmospheric CO2 into a mineral each year using seawater and scrap metal and producing hydrogen as a side product. That of course, is science.
Good. Scale it up.
Yeah,
baby.
So the idea is to make a method of converting atmospheric CO2 into a solid form that could then be, you know, used or buried.
Sequester
or whatever.
It, yeah.
Sequester.
Sure.
That's cheap and doesn't use a lot of energy. Obviously, if you do it using so much energy that you're just producing the CO2 that you're taking out of the atmosphere, it doesn't do anything. So they developed a technique. First of all, they didn't want to use anything expensive, so they used just scrap metal, like aluminum and other, just discarded aluminum cans that are not being recycled, et cetera, things that would otherwise just be in a landfill, and seawater, so fairly abundant. And then solar panels as the supply of energy. Obviously, you have to put energy into the system, and then you get out of it this mineralized form of CO2, hydrogen carbonate. Well, they say the carbon dioxide reacts with the water to create hydrogen carbonate, which then can be used to give rise to mineralized carbon dioxide. And then the waste product of this reaction is hydrogen, which could then be captured and used as a fuel source itself. Now, of course, you put more energy into the system than you get out. You have to because of thermodynamics, but you will recapture some of that energy in the hydrogen, which you could then use as a fuel, in a hydrogen fuel cell, or another in chemical reactions or whatever. Free hydrogen is actually very, very valuable. I had to look up, okay, so 850, they said it could produce this much in the analysis, this much atmospheric CO2 per year, 850 million tons it could take out of the atmosphere. But that's based upon what? What's the limit? Why can't they just build 10 of those factories? Is that just in the UK? Is that because the availability of scrap metal or whatever? I didn't know what their limit was. But do you guys know how much CO2 the world puts into the atmosphere every year?
Oh man, I'm
scared to hear. Yeah.
A lot.
850 billion tons?
I don't even know how to measure it.
38.2 billion tons.
38.2
so,
billion.
Oh, yeah, so my God. Like, so this is like a dust
50 mold. Times. Ugh. 50 times as much. I mean, it's not nothing, maybe 2% or whatever, 1 to 2% of the carbon dioxide that we're putting into the atmosphere. Now, of course, if we can get our CO2 production way down, and we can get this up tenfold or so, maybe then it could significantly eat into that. And we might even get to the point where we have negative, flux of CO2, start to bring the atmospheric levels down.
Get us back down to pre-industrial,
levels. Yep. Yeah.
I just want to see us stop producing more CO2.
Yeah. That'd be nice.
Like, even if we could just get it to where it is today, tomorrow.
Increasing the release of CO2.
Yes.
But, there are lots of sources of CO2 other than just producing energy. You know what a big one is?
Oh, yeah.
Farming.
Sure. Wait, methane,
farming,
isn't it?
Yeah, farming.
Yeah, although that methane's not as bad as CO2. It's a more potent, far more potent greenhouse gas. But
it doesn't stay permanently
in the atmosphere. It reacts, it goes away.
Yeah.
Which is why if you see it in an atmosphere in an exoplanet, you're like, whoa, there may be some life there because, there's chances are life is creating and not some weird geological process because it's temporary.
About 5% of the CO2 that we release comes from just the concrete industry, just making concrete.
Yep.
It's really bad for the environment, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's unfortunate because concrete is so unbelievably useful.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, but it's bad for the environment in lots of ways. Other ways, like think about what happened in Houston after the hurricane. Part of the reason that their flooding was so bad is they concreted
not
over
absorbing.
All of their marshlands. Yeah, like it's not good to just have a lot of concrete.
Well, they have
and
to,
no
you have to
grass.
Plan it out, so you have to leave somewhere for the water to go.
Yep. But also it makes cities a lot hotter, when you don't have a lot of sinks, basically.
Yeah.
You just have concrete everywhere. It brings a lot of heat to the city.
Well, I wouldn't consider that a problem with concrete. It's a problem with how it's being used. It's just a matter of how we're designing our cities. That's the problem.
Well, it's a problem with excessive use of it.
Yeah.
It's not just how it's being used, but it's just the amount of use.
Uh-huh. It's old school. You're talking old school concrete. I mean, I've seen examples of concrete and asphalt that you could basically dump a hoe, you dump a bucket or more on top of it, and it's absorbed right inside. It's amazing. The water just disappears. I saw an example of this like water truck that dumped probably hundreds and hundreds of gallons onto the asphalt, and the water disappeared. It's like goes away.
Yeah,
it was an amazing demonstration. Amazing.
So why aren't
we
building our roads out of it?
There you go.
Probably cost 10 times as much.
Well, there's...
Yeah. Probably cost 1.5 times as much. It's still too expensive.
Because we're waiting for the electric roadway, Steve.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yes. Solar roads.
Hexagonal tiles.
Which will never happen.
Oh, my God. It's so ridiculous.
Except on small garden pathways.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Technically not a road, though.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, Evan, take us out with a quote.
A theory which is not refutable by any conceivable event is non-scientific. Irrefutability is not a virtue of theory, as people often think, but a vice. Every genuine test of a theory is an attempt to falsify it or refute it. The wise, wise words of Karl Popper.
Yeah,
Popper, champion of falsification. Such an
Get in the Popper.
Such an important part of the scientific method.
Right, but in and of itself is not a litmus test for a theory being scientific, but it is a necessary but insufficient criterion
being
considered scientific. Yeah, it has to be falsifiable. But even beyond just that, that basic idea that a scientific theory has to be falsifiable is the notion that we tend to try, when we test our own ideas, our own thinking, it's our natural instinct to look for evidence to support it. And we should, in fact, be looking for evidence to refute it. So there's a psychological angle to this as well. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Good
episode. Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
Happy holiday. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. The whole deal, man.
Yeah, happy Festivus
coming
to all of you guys.
That's right.
And don't forget.
The Saturnalia.
Don't forget, set your calendar.
Friday, December 22nd, 8 p.m., we will be live streaming our end-of-the-year wrap-up show. So join us then. And Monday, December 18th at 7 p.m., we will be reviewing Star Wars on Alpha Quadrant 6. So take a look for at our Facebook page for that. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. Ha ha ha.